Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello, I'm Freddie Sayers and this is Unheard. Back in March, everyone's world suddenly changed.
From this evening, I must give the British people a very simple instruction. You must stay at home.
So on day one of lockdown, we launched Lockdown TV, a place where we could gather experts, scientists, writers, politicians, thinkers, to try to help us understand what was going on in this strange moment and what kind of world we were going to get at the end of it. And now, due to popular demand, here we are in podcast form. Welcome to Lockdown TV. So joining us today is one of the greatest public intellectuals of our time. He's called Richard Dawkins.
Scientism is not a word that I would use myself. It's a dirty word. It's used by people who are critical of scientists who they see as going too far.
You will know him from many bestsellers. Amongst the most famous are The Selfish Gene and The God Delusion, but he has written many other books. Indeed, there's a new one out shortly called Books Do Furnish a Life, which is a celebration of some of his science writing across a whole load of different topics. So let's start with the new book. I was looking through it and it's almost seems like a claiming of space beyond what people sometimes like to put science in. There's a lot of beautiful writing, there's talk of beauty, of magic, of other parts of life that we don't normally associate with science. Is that partly what the book was about?
Well, I suppose so, yes. It's about the literature of science, and it's actually just a collection of my book-related writing. So over the years, I've done a lot of book reviewing, a lot of writing of forewords to books, a few afterwords to books. So anything to do with books, Gillian Summerscales and I gathered together under the sort of umbrella of science as literature.
There's some passages in it. I've got just a quote here where you're talking about the beauty of nature. The streamlined beauty of a swimming whale, the muscular tautness of a stalking big cat, the iridescent extravaganza of peacock or scarlet macaw. I mean, this is almost sort of transcendent. Would you sign up to that adjective?
Well, I'm not sure. I certainly feel that science is a good vehicle for poetic writing, and so the passage you read there, I suppose, aspires to be poetic, and I do from time to time, but in general, I feel that scientists ought to write in a way that's attractive, readable, clear, and sometimes even poetic.
There's a moment in the writings where you talk about scientism, and your sense that that's a notion that sometimes reeled out in what you describe as a slightly snobbish way, where it seems like people are trying to sort of treat science as if it only exists on the rational sphere. What do you mean by scientism in that context, and how would you defend from it?
Scientism is not a word that I would use myself. It's a dirty word. It's used by people who are critical of scientists who they see as going too far and trying to usurp territory which properly belongs to other fields. So you need to ask somebody who actually uses the word scientism what they mean by it. What I understand by it is something negative, which is sometimes applied to me and which I disown. I think that science actually is the only way to understand what is true about the real world. I do not think that science is the right way to decide what is right and wrong, or what is aesthetically pleasing. That's a matter for others to judge.
So perhaps we actually had an essay by a philosopher called Matthew Crawford on Unheard recently about scientism, and I think his definition was when science moves from a mode of inquiry into a source of authority. And his worry was that particularly during these past pandemic months, there's been a sense that calls to science have been used to shut down debate in parts, or maybe to establish moral virtue. Are you anxious about that at all?
Well, I'd be surprised if it was used to establish moral virtue, but in the case of the pandemic, it really is about time we started listening to science. I mean, science is the way to discover the right answer to anything about the real world, and that, of course, includes how to deal with a serious epidemic like the one we're now going through. So we really do need to listen to science, and science should not, in this case, be accused of overstretching itself.
So when we get, for example, here in the UK, we've obviously had this new cadre of sort of scientist celebrities that we've all become familiar with from our TV sets every evening, who are epidemiologists who are suddenly now, you know, letting us know whether freedoms will be restored or not. Do you think there is a threshold, even if we haven't crossed it, when science starts becoming too political?
Epidemiology is the subject you need to know in order to make these decisions. The decisions are taken by politicians with scientific advice. And it's I suppose, can be a bit disconcerting when scientists disagree. But of course, they're bound to disagree because they're looking at this at different data, looking at the same data with different spectacles on. Scientists don't always agree about everything. But there is no other subject other than science which is going to tell you what the right thing to do is from an epidemiological point of view.
Well, if it becomes a moral or a societal question, really, whether what degree of risk or mortality one is prepared to live with in exchange for what kind of freedoms or way of life. I mean, that, I suppose, then is a political rather than a scientific question.
That's a good point, and that is a political decision because you have to balance what science tells you about the risks, as you say, with social costs, for example, the social cost of not being able to associate with your friends and relatives, the economic cost of industry shutting down, of not being able to go into shops. Commerce is badly affected. So these are all societal questions which have to be, as you say, balanced up against the risks which only science can tell you about.
And has your overall sense over the last year and a half been that we've got that balance about right in Western democracies, or have you been anxious about it at all?
I would say I'm not a good person to judge that. I mean, I think some countries have got it righter than others, and some countries have got it very wrong. It is a very difficult matter, and I do sympathize with politicians who have to take these difficult decisions. They're getting advice from scientists and rightly taking advice from scientists. On the other hand, they have to make decisions about the effects on the economy, the effects on social life and things. It is a very difficult matter, and some countries have got it better than others.
I wonder what your thoughts are on the kind of evolutionary impact of this new departure. It feels like it might be significant if we move from lots of individuals being selfish in the evolutionary sense and having different risk appetites and everybody working in their community or family or individual versus the new fashion, which is that, you know, a central expert group will decide on behalf of the whole of society what level of risk is permissible. That evolutionarily, that seems quite novel.
Yes. Well, I'm not sure about novel. I mean, it's true that in individual decisions people take, like, I'm not going to get vaccinated because I don't care, or it doesn't worry me, or I'm young and therefore I'm unlikely to get it seriously, and so on, have to be balanced against the social cost, in this case, epidemiological cost. One of the main lessons that epidemiology has taught us is that when you have an epidemic, there is a critical mass of people who, if you can get them vaccinated, then the epidemic will not spread. And so it is not a matter of self-interest. It should not be a matter of self-interest, because when you decide not to wear a mask, when you decide not to get vaccinated, it's not just a matter of your own decision for your own welfare, your own risk. You are actually risking other people if you do not do the social thing and get vaccinated or wear a mask, whatever the advice happens to be.
So would you be of the view then, those kinds of things, let's say vaccination, it would be morally acceptable to make them compulsory on that basis? Or do you feel that that would be a case of sort of science going too far? Where would you stand on that?
That's a case of politics going too far. I think that actual compulsion, go to jail if you're not vaccinated, I wouldn't do that. But I think it would be a good idea to explain to people that it really is a moral responsibility. It's a bit like explaining to people, it's not quite like driving on the proper side of the road, left or right side of the road. But it's kind of like that. It's a social responsibility that many people simply don't understand. Especially in America, you'll hear people saying, well, I'm prepared to take the risk. That's not the point. It's not the point whether you're prepared to take the risk. The point is that you're risking other people's lives. And without resorting to compulsion, I think very strong persuasion, put it that way.
Perhaps if we zoom out a little bit, there's a conversation in your book between you and Christopher Hitchens back in 2011, when you're discussing whether America is in danger of becoming a theocracy. And I wonder what your reflections are on how things have changed since then, and whether the new trends in America are the same as they were, or whether the theocratic threat comes from different quarters. Do you think we're in a different world than we were then?
I think things are getting better in America. The trends reflected in the polls suggest that things are getting better. The number of people who do not subscribe to a religion, the so-called nones, N-O-N-E-S, so-called nones, are now up to about 25%, which is about as many as any particular religious denomination in America. So that's pretty good news. It's not news which has reached the eyes of politicians necessarily, because they still seem to feel the need to suck up to religious special interest groups and to ignore the non-believers in America. But statistically, things are going the right direction, I think, since that interview with Christopher Hitchens.
I wonder what your response would be to the idea that some of the religious impulse that was more talked about at that period is now having more secular outlets. In terms of cultural questions, sometimes it seems like the secular extreme atheist part of society is feeling almost religious fervor about a new set of issues. Do you observe that?
I'm not sure quite what you mean by that. Do you mean that atheism is becoming a religion in its own right, something like that?
Well, just that, I mean, I'm not sure if you ever read that there's a famous blog post by Scott Alexander which dissected the so-called new atheism era and tried to make the case that some of those atheist plus activists have sort of progressed into being more social justice activists now, and there's been a sort of transfer of that. And I suppose that's the question, really, whether some of the atheist movement has become a political movement in that sense.
I'm interested in science. I'm not interested in politics or sociology.
Okay. It is often said that some very secular issues these days have something of a religious fervour. There are writers like Tom Holland, who is a writer we have published here at Unheard, who would make the case that it's a kind of post-Christian inheritance, and that even some of the atheist movement has a post-Christian atmosphere. How do you respond to that?
Well, by post-Christian, you could mean we've given up Christianity, or it could mean that we have our historical roots in Christianity.
I think the second, I suppose, he means.
Yes, I think that's probably undeniable. I mean, we come from, those of us who do actually come from a Christian heritage undeniably do. And so the historical roots of where we're coming from are in Christianity. That, I suppose, is undeniable. That's not in any sense a defense of Christianity. It's not in any sense meaning that that you can't be an atheist without being post-Christian, anything like that. But it's just a historical fact, which I suppose is mildly interesting, not very.
Let me open the floor to you then and ask, of these points and of the essays you've collected, which ones stand out most of all? And what do you think, what do you want people to hear about?
Yes, there's one of Edward Wilson, the famous entomologist and evolutionist and ecologist. And it's a very critical, one of the more critical reviews, because I think that Edward Wilson went astray. I mean, a brilliant man, a brilliant career, but I think that he, towards the end of his career, went astray by rejecting what I regard as one of the more fundamental theories of evolution of social life, that of W.D. Hamilton, kin selection. Balance that with a very positive one.
Could you tell us about that just for a moment? What did he get wrong on kin selection?
Oh, okay. Well, kin selection, as you may know, is the theory of social life based on genes. So animals are expected, in the theory of natural selection, theory of neo-Darwinism, to behave altruistically towards any other individuals who share their genes. And this is why we have parental care. Parental care seems obvious.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
But parental care is only a special case of caring for other individuals who share the same genes. Caring for siblings, caring for nephews and nieces is just like parental care. It's just that there are more practical opportunities to care for your offspring than there are to care for your siblings or your nephews and nieces. But genetically speaking, it's the same thing. Now, that's the theory which was developed by W.D. Hamilton in the 1960s and is the foundation of really the whole of modern behavioral ecology, the whole of modern ethology, sociobiology. And it was central to Wilson's great book, Sociobiology, in 1975. But then more recently, in the 2000s, he has rejected all that and started talking about group selection in a very unhelpful way, I think. So that's the basis
And group selection is different because it ignores the genetic component.
Sort of, yes. It says that the reason why animals are altruistic is that groups that contain altruistic individuals survive better than groups that don't. And that's kind of true if groups are kin groups. but it's more theoretically economical to go right to the level of the genes and to say that animals, or rather actually genes, care for copies of themselves, which leads to animals caring for other animals, which contain copies of the same genes.
If we apply those ideas to the human species, the idea of kin selection and looking after your genetic in-group, is that something that we should be worried about, or is that something that is just a fact of human life? Do you think we need to mitigate against it? How do we apply that to humans?
Well, humans are a difficult species to deal with because we've departed in cultural evolution. Modern society has departed a long way from the environment in which our genes were naturally selected. If you look at primitive peoples like the Anamamo in the Brazilian jungle, or like the Kalahari, the Khoisan, then you see something much closer to what you would expect on the theory of kin selection. Another of the essays in the book is about Napoleon Chagnon, who was a great anthropologist who studied the Yanomami in Brazil. And he was somewhat unusual among anthropologists at the time in that he bothered to learn up some Darwinism. And he applied his Darwinism to the Yanomami and showed how beautifully kin selection, Darwinism generally, explains the behavior of the so-called fierce people. They live in village groups, and they're extremely aggressive. They fight over women. They do all the kinds of things which a Darwinian might expect. But in modern societies like ours, we don't see that in any simple way. There are disciplines like called evolutionary psychology, which try to interpret modern society in those terms with a certain amount of success, but it has to be done in a rather clever, indirect way, rather than in the more direct way that you can apply it to societies like the Khoisan or the Yanomami.
I guess what I meant is that people get very anxious if you talk about kin selection in a broader sense amongst humans, because it feels like you're edging up against some sort of ethnicities or tribes or those kind of divisions that we seem to have, we've been working hard to downweight.
Yes, I think it is very difficult, and I think you have to tread very carefully. I think it's probably safest not to apply these ideas in any kind of naive or simplistic way. You have to be very sophisticated about it.
If we look at the bigger picture, you mentioned how America has become a lot more secular since that conversation you had with Christopher Hitchens. The UK is also showing extraordinary fall off in religious allegiance. Would the hope, in your view, be that that falls to zero, or is there a kind of dream scenario here?
Yes, to me, the hope would be that it falls to zero. Christopher Hitchens disagreed with that. He rather paradoxically, he denied that he was a contrarian. I think this is a rather contrarian point of view. He liked having religious people around so that he could argue with them. I prefer religious belief to fall to zero, but that does not mean that I like to get rid of all the cultural baggage that goes with it, because that includes beautiful music, beautiful art, beautiful poetry. I would not wish to be without the B minor Mass or Mozart's Requiem. These are wonderful, wonderful pieces of music, and the same goes for great art, of course, and great literature. The Bible itself is great literature, at least in the authorized version. You cannot appreciate English literature unless you're well up in the Bible, because so many of the allusions, the proverbial references and things, come straight from the Bible. The God Delusion, my book, The God Delusion, has, I think, about 3 pages of proverbial or sayings, which come straight from the Bible and which you actually need to have some familiarity with the Bible in order to understand and appreciate English literature.
Would it also be quite a new experiment for our species to be an atheist species in that sense? I mean, I guess you or I couldn't predict what exactly the side effects of that might be. Is there any chance, do you think, that religion actually had a kind of a safety mechanism and contained certain impulses that, if we didn't have it at all, might come out more dangerously elsewhere?
It's possible. I can't think of any very specific examples of that.
I think politics might be one. Yeah. You know, people get...
I don't know about politics. I mean, in America, certainly politicians pay lip service to being religious, and they always say God bless America at the end of every speech, and they mention God at every possible opportunity. British politicians don't do that. Some of them may be religious, many of them are not, but it doesn't seem to enter into their debates very much. Certain particular issues, maybe it does, maybe certain moral issues where people will appeal to religious standards, religious ethics, but we certainly do not need religion in order to get ethical standards. We've got moral philosophy, which is a very highly developed discipline and has many good things to say. We can get our morals, we certainly should get our morals from other places than religion. If we got them from religion, they'd be pretty, pretty unpleasant.
How do you think that's going so far, our collective attempt as a species to get our morals from other places than religion, in the most recent 10 years where it's shown the most dramatic decline? I mean, can we make any deductions how well that experiment is going?
Well, I think that there is definitely, over historical time, a trend towards getting more what I would call moral, what you would probably call moral. We're getting nicer. Things are getting better from a moral point of view. Steven Pinker documents this massively in his book, The Better Angels of Our Nature. We no longer have public executions, public torturings. We no longer have the stocks where we throw rotten eggs at people. We no longer torture cats for the sheer amusement. Bullfighting is going out. So there are strong trends in what I think you and I would both agree are the right direction. And these are secular trends. Religious people have possibly contributed, for example, to the abolition of slavery, but that was in the teeth of other religious people. Slavery is sanctioned in the Bible, after all. So things like the abolition of slavery, the decline of racism, the decline of sexism, all these good trends are, I think, in the main secular trends.
So there's an interesting dialogue with Steven Pinker in your book as well. I wonder, are there points where you take issue with him or his kind of ultra-optimistic view of the progress of our species? Are there points where you would be more hesitant about how well it's all going?
He's one of the great optimists, and he's remarkably articulate and well-informed about it. Matt Ridley is another of the people that I talk to, who is another celebrated optimist coming from a more economic point of view. I hesitate to be quite so optimistic as my friends, Steve Pinker and Matt Ridley.
What are you less optimistic about, I suppose? I'm keen to know if there are anything that troubles you about.
I suppose about climate change. I mean, I think Matt Ridley is optimistic, as he believes that science can solve problems and always has solved problems, and that big as the problems may seem to be at the present time, he has a kind of faith that science will come through and solve those problems. And I would like to believe that. Perhaps we need a bit of a dose of optimism, but I'm not sure that I'm well enough informed, actually, to go as far as he does.
So overall, do you feel that, you know, if you look around at the state of the world and the state of our species in a more general sense, you're not worried about the direction? Because, you know, we get a lot of guests on this show and we have a lot of people who really think we're in a difficult time. Things are becoming more tribal. I've heard people say that the era of rational thought is sort of dying away and we are returning to a more tribal way of thinking. Do you have sympathy with any of that anxiety?
Well, put it this way, if I thought that was going to happen, I mean, if I thought that the world was going to descend into, use a Churchillian phrase, a new dark age with a lack of rationality, I would be very, very upset indeed. I find it hard to imagine a worse scenario, really, than that we should descend into superstition and irrationality and lack of scientific sense. So I certainly hope that isn't happening. I cannot believe it really is. If there are short-term trends in the wrong direction, then let's hope they're short-term. As for climate change, which is, I think, a very serious problem, nobody would deny that that's a very serious problem. If it is to be solved, it will be science that solves it. And let's hope that it does, but we must not be complacent. That's certainly true.
So you would conclude with a note of cautious optimism, perhaps, Richard, that we needn't tear our hair out, that the age of rationality is dead.
That was a hope, and a very strong hope, and I got to be optimistic and believe that. As for climate change, I think we've got to take it very, very seriously and trust in science. If anything can save us, science will.
Richard Dawkins, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
That was Richard Dawkins, the famous atheist and author, sharing some of his thoughts on a new book he's got coming out and much else. Thanks to him for joining and to you for watching. This was Lockdown TV.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.